in the queue to get the help.
Mr. John Sparks, the chief executive of Homeless Charity Crisis, has said, "You cannot free people from the cycle of homelessness without a proper home and, crucially, the support they need to keep it long-term." Amnesty International adds that frontline services warn they are at breaking point due to a rise in homelessness, and that the UK could be facing a human rights catastrophe. At the same time, when it comes to housing difficulties, black households are particularly at risk.
As the UK experiences yet another rise in COVID-19, and as Boris Johnson appears focused on his own survival, his government struggles to solve the homelessness issue. The Prime Minister could himself be evicted from Downing Street. Yet his problems are small compared to being homeless or sleeping rough day after day, while the government's COVID crisis has made it even less able to help one of the most vulnerable groups in the country, people with nowhere to live.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Disappointingly, U.S. actions are a key reason that the international community has been unable to enforce international law where the Zionist regime is concerned, says Ron Forthfor Ryder in an article titled, "The U.S. Enables Criminal Israeli Regime Behavior." Stay tuned for more. Given all the attention focused on the COVID-19 pandemic, the Build Back Better bill, the January 6 attack on the Capitol, and the media-hyped crises over Ukraine and Taiwan this past year, many other important issues have not received much attention. One example is the Palestinian-Israeli regime situation. There have been some major breakthroughs in the perception of the Zionist regime in 2021, with two major human rights organizations, B'Tselem and Human Rights Watch, concluding that the Zionist regime is an apartheid regime. In addition, this past May, 93 U.S. rabbinical students wrote a letter challenging the Zionist perception of Israel. They wrote, "As American Jews, our institutions tell stories of Israel rooted in hope for what could be, but oblivious to what is. Our Tzedakah money funds a story we wish were true, but perpetuates a reality that is untenable and dangerous. Our political advocacy too often puts forth a narrative of victimization, but supports violent suppression of human rights and enables apartheid in the Palestinian territories and the threat of annexation." The Zionist regime violates international law with impunity. There was also a particularly strong statement to the UN General Assembly this past October by Michael Ling, the Special Rapporteur for the Situation of Human Rights in the Palestinian Territory occupied since 1967. Ian Williams wrote about Ling's statement in the January to February 2022, the issue of the Washington Report on the West Asian Affairs. Williams quoted from Ling's statement, "The international community has been perplexingly unwilling to meaningfully challenge, let alone act decisively to reverse, the momentous changes that Israel has been generating on the ground. This is a political failure of the first order. This very same international community, speaking through the principal political and legal organs of the United Nations, has established the widely accepted and detailed rights-based framework for the supervision and resolution of the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Accordingly, the protracted Israeli occupation must fully end." Williams noted that Link also addressed the lack of action in following up on UN Security Council resolutions. Link said, "Regrettably, the international community's remarkable tolerance for Israeli exceptionalism in its conduct of the occupation has allowed realpolitik to trump rights, power to supplant justice, and impunity to undercut accountability. This has been a conspicuous threat throughout the Madrid-Oslo peace process, which began in 1991. This past December 23rd, on the fifth anniversary of the UN Security Council's passing of Resolution 2334, Link said that Resolution 2334, adopted by the Security Council on December 23rd, 2016, stated that Israeli settlements constitute a flagrant violation under international law, and said that all settlement activities in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Al-Quds, must immediately and completely cease. If this resolution had been actually enforced by the international community and obeyed by Israel, we would most likely be on the verge of a just and lasting peace, the special rapporteur said, adding, "Instead, Israel is in defiance of the resolution. Its occupation is more entrenched than ever. The violence it employs against the Palestinians to sustain the occupation is rising, and the international community has no strategy to end the world's longest military occupation." Link added, without decisive international intervention to impose accountability upon an unacceptable and unaccountable occupation, there is no hope that the Palestinian right to self-determination and an end to the conflict will be realized anytime in the foreseeable future. Disappointingly, U.S. actions are a key reason that the international community has been unable to enforce international law where the Zionist regime is concerned. For example, according to a May 19, 2021 Al Jazeera article, the U.S. has vetoed 53 U.N. Security Council resolutions critical of the Zionist regime's behavior since 1972. These shameful vetoes provide political cover for continuing the Zionist regime's crimes against Palestinians. In addition, the U.S. also gives $3.8 billion in aid each year to the Zionist regime, primarily for military assistance that, among other things, supports the Zionist regime's oppression of Palestinians and the occupation of Palestinian land. If peace and justice are to prevail, the U.S. must join with other nations to stop the Zionist regime's crimes instead of abetting the criminality.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi hosted his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdullahian in the city of Buji in Jiangsu province on Friday.
The Chinese and Iranian foreign ministers announced the launch of a 25-year cooperation agreement aimed at strengthening economic and political ties.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the strategic cooperation agreement between Tehran and Beijing is built on a win-win approach in line with the interests of both countries. The Iranian diplomat outlined the latest state of bilateral cooperation in various fields and said Tehran is resolved to implement all infrastructure agreements with Beijing. Iran and China signed the landmark Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement in March last year in defiance of the U.S. unilateral sanctions to strengthen the long-standing economic and political alliance. It paves the way for Iran's participation in the Belt and Road Initiative, a massive infrastructure project stretching from East Asia to Europe. Meanwhile, Beijing once again voiced its firm opposition to unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States against Iran. The Chinese foreign minister said the U.S. bears primary responsibility for the ongoing difficulties with Iran, having unilaterally withdrawn from a 2015 nuclear deal. The United States reimposed the sanctions that the agreement had removed and slapped new bans under different labels. Wang said China firmly opposes unilateral sanctions against Iran, political manipulation through topics including human rights, and interference in the internal affairs of Iran and other regional countries. He also noted that Beijing completely supports Iran's wise stand toward the bullying policies of the United States, and also its position on the ongoing
talks with the five remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear agreement,
urging Washington to make up for the past mistake in withdrawing from the deal.
That this 25-year agreement with China represents new possibilities for Iran to really, if not break out of the sanctions, at least they have a lifeline for the things that they will need thanks to this long-term agreement with China. And for China, of course, it's a major undertaking because it is long-term. They do expect it to last over two decades. So this is something that is a permanent feature of the political architecture, and I think it represents a tremendous opening for Iran to retake its own rightful place in the array of nations of the world, in the Middle East and globally.
Since Washington's 2018 withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, followed by subsequent sanctions aimed at crushing the Iranian economy, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has underlined the necessity of pressing ahead with efforts to neutralize the sanctions. Under that strategy, Iran has tried to adopt an east-oriented economic policy, expanding its ties with neighboring and other Asian countries and striving to become self-sufficient in key domains. China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from the country. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. Also, a review of trade between Iran and Russia shows Tehran's exports to Moscow increased by 58%, including 62% in agricultural and food products in the first 9 months of the current Persian year, which ends on March 20th. Tehran says a long-term cooperation roadmap between Iran and Russia is at its final stage of development as the Islamic Republic takes the initiative to expand its ties with neighboring, regional, and friendly countries to neutralize sanctions.
China and Russia are fighting back. They're going to be playing a major role. They're going to maintain their relations with the countries that they have a good relationship with and Iran is one of these. And they're not going to be bullied by the independent or unilateral sanctions or even any other sanctions that would be placed on a country like Iran's.
Tehran has also pursued the removal of sanctions through diplomatic channels, including the negotiations in Austria's capital, Vienna.
The eighth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA goes on in Vienna to revive the deal.
Tehran says all anti-Iran sanctions should be removed in a verifiable manner. Tehran also says the U.S. should give guarantees that it won't leave the deal again.
Tensions between Russia and the West are spiraling out of control. The West is accusing Moscow of planning to invade its western neighbor, Ukraine, citing increased Russian military activities along the border. Russia rejects the allegation and says its military buildup is to ensure security in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. Back in December, Russia proposed two draft treaties to Washington and NATO that demanded assurances that Western troops won't be deployed near Russian borders. Last week, U.S. and Russian officials held talks over the tensions. Soviet representatives from NATO and Moscow to de-escalate the situation. The talks ended without any significant breakthrough. Russia now says it has run out of patience with the West as tensions escalate over Ukraine. Moscow expects the U.S. and NATO to provide by next week a detailed written response to its security demands.
We're waiting for the written reaction. We have reasons to believe that our partners have understood the necessity to react quickly, precisely, and on paper. And they have understood that we're not going to wait forever. But of course, there are plans to drag it on and on.
Sergei Lavrov says Moscow needs legally binding guarantees, and meeting these demands would be essential for finding a diplomatic solution. According to Lavrov, his country has various options if the West rejects its security proposals.
I think the most likely thing is that they would announce that they're putting ships off the American coast with hypersonic weapons on them that could reach American cities within 5 or 7 minutes, similar to the threat they say they're facing in Eastern Europe. I think there are things they could do in Ukraine, for example, hitting the Azov battalion or some of the bases the Ukrainians have put on the Sea of Azov. They could deploy weapons to Kaliningrad Oblast. They could be announcing the targeting of European capitals. I think there are many things they could do to increase the pain level in Europe.
Russia has long warned against Ukraine's possible membership in NATO, describing it as its red line. Russia is raising the stakes by suggesting that it might deploy military hardware to Venezuela and Cuba if the escalation talks fail. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov, who led Russia's delegation in a meeting with the U.S. on Monday, says the move depends on the actions of the Americans. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan dismissed the warning as bluster, adding that the paths forward are either diplomacy or confrontation.
I think there's a chance of a compromise, but I think the chances are extremely small. I know some observers have taken some indications that maybe privately the Americans are willing to be more willing to make concessions to Moscow security demands, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think the Russians feel they were giving one last chance for the Western countries, particularly the United States, to see reason and give them security guarantees. I don't think that's going to happen.
Moscow and the West have had strained relations since the 2014 repatriation of Crimea from Ukraine to Russia, following a referendum in which more than 90% voted in favor of the move. The West, nonetheless, described it as illegal. The European Union and some other Western countries joined Washington in introducing several rounds of sanctions against Russia. The tense relations between the U.S. and Russia took a turn for the worse after Washington withdrew from Cold War-era IMF and Open Skies treaties. The recent tensions are definitely a cause for concern for people around the world, because if a second Cold War gets out of control, it could prove costlier than the first for all sides.
Arab intellectuals and ordinary people are still angry over UAE's normalization of ties with Israel. A number of intellectuals from Persian Gulf Arab states have announced that they will boycott a literature festival that is set to take place in Abu Dhabi in February. Omani writer Bushra Khalfan and Kuwaiti writers Mona Al-Shamri, Ahmed Al-Zamam and Ali Ashur decided to boycott the Emirates Airlines Festival of Literature.
Yeah, I guess this development indeed shows that there is a large number of people who disapprove. And that has been the case all along, because we need to keep in mind that these regimes are not elected by their population, and they don't necessarily make decisions on behalf of the population in these countries.
The intellectuals have cited UAE's normalization of ties with Israel for the decision to boycott the event. The list of invitees included writers, academics, and intellectuals from a number of Arab countries. Other writers from Persian Gulf countries have also been called to withdraw from the event. The festival will take place from February the 3rd to 13th at its new venue for 2022. UAE's image has been tarnished amongst Arab intellectuals and ordinary people for its decision to normalize ties. Palestinians have described the move as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
And of course, the public communication and freedom of speech is very strongly restricted in the UAE, which means that public dissent and in this case, and of course, public expressions against the normalization with the Israeli regime, of course, can lead to consequences for the populations.
The United Arab Emirates is amongst a group of Arab states that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime as part of a controversial initiative brokered by the United States in 2020. The Emiratis opened their embassy in Israel in July 2021. Israel has also opened an embassy in the Emirates capital, Abu Dhabi, and the consulate in the UAE business hub, Dubai. Over the past year, the two sides have signed many deals ranging from financial services to tourism. And in December, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett visited the UAE to further deepen the ties between the two regimes. The UAE was not the only country to normalize its ties with Israel. Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco have also established diplomatic relations with the Tel Aviv regime. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has already vowed to help Israel normalize relations with additional countries in the Muslim and Arab worlds. Blinken said the Biden administration would continue to build on the successful efforts of the last administration to keep normalization marching forward.
Well, the Israeli colony is in many ways a proxy and a military base for the United States, and it helps secure the U.S. role in Western Asia and beyond. So, of course, the Israeli regime is of essential importance for the United States, and expanding Israel's ties to the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and then potentially other governments and regimes in the region is, of course, of central interest because Israel is central for the military-industrial complex.
Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. The stance adopted by these Arab governments seem to be helping the Israeli regime to move out of deep isolation in the West Asia region. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back.
Now, that, as a result, of course, the Palestinian struggle has not been of any importance, or has even rather become an obstacle for many of these regimes. But at the same time, of course, it does not reflect necessarily the popular mood in these places, where many people are, of course, pro-Palestinian and do support the liberation of Palestine.
Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today, as several Arab states are undermining the Palestinian cause by moving closer to Israel.
Earlier this month, in his New Year message, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un pledged once again to boost Pyongyang's defenses. He said North Korea would continue to bolster its military capabilities because the peninsula still faces an increasingly unstable military environment. And now Kim seems determined to fulfill that pledge. This week he oversaw a hypersonic missile test. North Korean media said the projectile launched on Tuesday successfully made a turn before destroying its target 1,000 kilometers away. It was North Korea's third test of such a missile. South Korea's military acknowledged that the latest missile launch demonstrated quote-unquote improvement from previous tests. The North seems resolute on its path to master the new technology. Unlike ballistic missiles that fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory, hypersonic weapons fly at lower altitudes, making them less vulnerable to interception. The main feature of hypersonic weapons is their maneuverability, which makes them much harder to detect by radar. North Korea is now undoubtedly among a small number of countries, including the United States, racing to develop hypersonic weapons. The United States and some of its allies were quick to condemn the North's latest test. The U.S. did not stop there. It later announced sanctions against a number of individuals for their alleged roles in producing goods for Pyongyang's weapons program. The U.S. administration said the measures are aimed at preventing the advancement of North Korea's military programs and to block its attempts to develop weapons technologies. The sanctions imposed by the U.S. Treasury freeze all U.S. assets of those who are targeted and generally bans Americans from doing any business with them. Can such measures put obstacles in the way of North Korea's development of advanced weapons? Past experience shows that's highly unlikely because Pyongyang has been subjected to Western sanctions for many years. It has suffered under sanctions, but it has somehow managed to withstand the American pressure campaign.
Those sanctions continue to implement not just food, but also medicine, technology, equipment to make life impossible for the people of the DPRK, just as they're doing in Iran, just as they're doing in Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. But I think that these sanctions are not going to have much of an effect any longer, because we have to remember that the era of U.S. dominance, of the single dominance hegemony of the U.S. is over.
Despite its long list of economic problems, the North has managed to produce several nuclear warheads, describing them as a necessary insurance against an attack by the U.S. The North seems to deeply distrust America. Under former U.S. President Donald Trump, America and North Korea came close to a conflict before a series of meetings between the two adversaries. The high-profile summits broke down with no agreement. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden insists that it is open to dialogue with North Korea. But Pyongyang seems to have learned a lesson from Trump's era and his futile attempts at detente.
I think the Biden administration, while in appearance it may seem that it's more progressive or more prone to dialogue, in reality it is very much achieving the same goals as Trump and the Republican strategy in general against the DPRK, which is regime change.
Pyongyang has described American diplomatic overtures as empty rhetoric without meaningful changes to hostile policies, including war games close to its borders and economic sanctions. The latest American sanctions are expected to further complicate the situation.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's recommendations on political groups, especially MKO terrorist organization, and said that he had advised all terrorist groups to return back to the ocean of the Iranian nation and stop acts of terror to satisfy their masters in the West or the East. In this episode, we are going to touch upon his stance on leftist and separatist groups. Stay tuned, please. coincident with the victory of the Russian Revolution of 1917 and coming to power of communist ideology in the country, leftist thoughts grew in many countries, particularly in the neighbors of Soviet Union, including Iran. Though the religious fabric of Iran and the sensitivity of the ruling system never led them to spread much among masses. Tudeh Party was the most important organized group among the leftist groups which came to existence in Iran after the Second World War. This party was eradicated in two phases. First, after the assassination attempt against the Shah in Tehran University, and then in the post-1953 coup period. Thus, its leaders and advocates escaped or were tortured or executed. A few of them also turned into spies of the regime through the pressures and temptations of the Shah agents. In 1960s, due to the increase of partisan struggles inspired by the thoughts of Che Guevara, Mao and Castro, and closure of political climate in Iran, some youth and students started armed struggles against the Shah. They intended to spread armed and partisan struggles to the whole society a la China and Cuba to topple the regime. But the Shah regime was fully supported by the U.S. As a result, the members of such groups would soon be identified and repressed before taking any serious measure. These groups were totally destroyed in late 1960s and early 1970s. At that time, the regime of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was in its most powerful days, thanks to the exorbitant oil revenues and relying on security and military support of the U.S. and allies. In such circumstances, Imam Khomeini started his struggle against the Shah and the U.S. with trust in God and relying on people's all-out support. Millions of men and women from all walks of life answered positively to Imam Khomeini's call to show their opposition to the regime of Shah. Therefore, they poured to the streets and chanted anti-regime slogans. The Imam's all-encompassing umbrella had indeed covered all political parties and every social stratum. Thus, the Islamic Revolution triumphed in a few months to the bewilderment of all analysts. Without doubt, the key element in this victory was the unmatched personality of Imam Khomeini and his charismatic leadership. The course of the revolution left no choice for political parties but to join the masses even if they didn't believe in the ideology and ideals of the Imam and the people. This was the means for most of them to survive. The leftist groups had no belief in Islam, but had to join the people to survive. However, after the victory, they started to act as opposition and counter-revolutionary elements. They left no stone unturned to hurt the Islamic Revolution. Imam Khomeini time and again advised them to return to the Islamic Revolution and the Iranian nation. But they insisted on their stubborn thoughts and were finally exterminated. The Imam writes in his testament, "My recommendation to the leftists, like communists and Fadaiye Khalq partisans and other groups with leftist tendencies, is that without proper studying of ideologies and the ideology of Islam, with those who are well aware of ideologies, especially Islam, which motive has satisfied you to be inclined to the ideology that has failed in the world today? And what has happened that you have become content with few isms, whose content is null with researchers? What has motivated you to intend to draw your country to the lap of the Soviets or China and to fight your nation in the name of love of two-day party or hatch plots to the benefit of foreigners against your country and oppressed masses? Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, addressing leftist groups, writes in his testament, "You can see that since the onset of communism, its masqueraders have been the most dictatorial, the most power-seeking, and the most monopolist governments in the world. What nations were smashed and annihilated under the rule of the Soviet, claiming to support masses? The Russian nation, Muslims and non-Muslims, have been struggling with twitches under the pressure of the Communist Party and are denied any freedom and are living in suffocation worse than that of the world dictators. Stalin, who was one of the so-called bright figures of the party, we were witness to his coming and going and his protocols and aristocracy. Now that you, the Beagle, are sacrificing your life for that regime, the oppressed people of the Soviet and its satellites like Afghanistan are dying of their oppressions." Imam Khomeini continues to advise the leftists, "You who are claiming the advocacy of people, what crimes you have committed against these people wherever you could, as with the noble people of Amol, who you wrongly called your strong advocates and sent many of them deceptively to fight people and the government to be killed. You want to offer the Iranian oppressed and deprived nation to the Soviet dictatorship, and you are doing this treason under the guise of Fadai-e Khalq, an advocates of the deprived. The Tudeh Party and its cohorts are doing this through conspiracy under the mask of supporting the Islamic Republic, while other groups are doing it through arms, terror, and blasts." Imam Khomeini writes in continuation, "I write as testament to you parties and groups, either those who are known as leftists or those who are feeding from and inspired by the West, or even those such as Democratic or Komole parties who take arms in the name of autonomy and advocacy of Kurds and Baluch, and have destroyed the deprived people of Kurdistan and other places, and prevent cultural, hygiene, and economic services and reconstruction by the government on those provinces to join the nation. Now that they have experienced that they have done nothing and can't do anything but making the inhabitants miserable, so it is to their benefit and that of the nations and regions to assist the government and give up rebellion, serving the foreigners, and betrayal of their country. They should embark on building the country and be sure that Islam is better for them than both the criminal Western Pole and the dictatorial Eastern Pole, and it will fulfill the humane wishes of people better."
Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavik, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
For Afghan students, the year 2021 was full of obstacles. The educational system was disrupted and many schools across remained closed, while a ban on girls returning to secondary schools is still in place.
Now the Filimoya School has opened for students in Afghanistan to facilitate learning. This Iranian platform provides Afghan students with free educational courses.
Samira and Fatima are students of secondary school. After being banned from attending their classes, they decided to join online courses.
Hello everyone, how are you?
Now they are students of Filimoy School and they are happy with everything it has provided.
It has been almost 152 days that we have been away from school. We felt very desperate. In order to stay involved with education, my friends and I gather here and benefit from Filimo School's online courses. The lessons and videos provided by Filimo are very interesting and creative.
Teachers and educational consultants believe that online courses are a good means of learning, especially at a time of crisis and pandemic. Mahdi Ishaqi, who is an education consultant, has found Filimo Online School very professional and useful for Afghan students.
I found the Filimo school extraordinarily useful, especially for Afghan students who are affected by a political crisis and the coronavirus pandemic. This is very valuable academically too. I'm sure our students highly welcome Filimo school because they are in need of such opportunities.
Filimo school says it has provided the service to Afghan students because of their difficult educational conditions. So now every Afghan boy and girl from preschool to the ninth grade can access the same lessons as Iranians do. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Bedouin Palestinians have been living in the Naqab Desert for decades, even before the creation of Israel. It's home to tens of thousands of residents who view these lands as privately owned. Still, Israel has refused to recognize these Palestinian inhabitants and is now claiming that the lands have been registered and belong to the Israeli regime. The latest incursion into Bedouin territories gave rise to a fresh round of escalation, with angry Palestinians turning out, saying the Israeli forestation project is not but an excuse to force them out of their land.
The goal of the tree planting is to prevent the expansion of the Bedouin villages, to prevent a future recognition in our villages, and this action is somewhat political. The extreme right wing used it to spoil the relationship between Jews and Arabs in this place. We say to them, this is our land, these are our villages, we've been here for hundreds and thousands of years, and we will simply not move from this place.
The crackdown turned violent in no time, with Israeli forces targeting the Palestinian demonstrators with all they had, from rubber-coated bullets and tear gas to stun grenades and skunk water. Palestinian families have been living in constant fear and apprehension due to Israel's forced displacements. A controversial case has been the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Israel has for some time been seeking the expulsion of several Palestinian families from their houses in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Al-Quds, in what pro-Palestine groups have been seeing as the continuation of Israel's attempts at ethnic cleansing and Judaization of Palestinian territories. And the regime's demolition of Palestinian residences and businesses has turned into an almost daily occurrence. Palestinians say settlements built on occupied territory will get in the way of them building their future state. They have demanded that Israel freeze all settlement activity if it wants the peace process to resume. But Israel is pushing ahead, taking no heed of those demands. Some experts believe Israel has been planning from the start to expand and perpetuate its occupation, and the two-state solution was never an option for the Tel Aviv to begin with.
There was never a plan for a future Palestinian state. A two-state solution, so-called, is not a solution. It's a delusion, and it's an illusion that was instituted by basically Ben-Gurion in the 1920s.
All these developments take place as the international community plays the role of a silent witness of the Israeli colonial policies. And all these Palestinian pleas for help and justice are falling on deaf ears. That has many wondering what can be done to make the world quit its role as a silent observer of the injustice that's been committed against Palestinians.
On Friday, EU foreign affairs and defense ministers concluded 2 days of talks, which were dominated by the subject of Russia. They assert Moscow is preparing to invade Ukraine.
Any further military aggression against Ukraine will have massive consequences and severe cost in response. And this includes restrictive measures that will be adopted in coordination with our partners.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow's patience with the West has expired. The Kremlin demands an end to NATO's military buildup close to its borders, and any idea of Ukraine joining the alliance to be ruled out. We have been asking EU citizens to give their views on the crisis.
There will always be tensions, as long as people have different views and are standing in their views.
Just communication and dialogue, that always helps.
I mean, Russia has got an enormous nuclear arsenal. We don't. Well, Europe doesn't. So we have to, tread carefully.
I think we don't need any more conflict, no?
They should just find a middle way to live with each other and don't start a war.
We don't need any war. Of course not. We want peace. All of us.
The EU has donated more than 12 billion euro to the Ukrainian government since 2014. A European Court of Auditors report published last September showed how corruption in the country is rife at the highest levels. During their talks, EU foreign affairs ministers also discussed ongoing efforts to try and get the Iran nuclear deal back on track. France's Jean-Yves Le Drian told journalists after the meeting that negotiations in Vienna are moving much too slowly and a decision must be reached. But back to Russia, and the ministers claim they want more constructive dialogue with Moscow. But impartial analysts are asking, how can they be serious amid relentless anti-Russia rhetoric and the ongoing implementation of sanctions? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Saturday, Rome, Milan and Naples, Italy's largest cities, saw protesters railing against the vaccine passports that are now required to access much of public life. The largest demonstration was held in the Italian capital, Rome, where over 5,000 people gathered in iconic St. John's Square to express their anger at the Mario Draghi government's latest COVID restrictions. The new law has expanded the scope of the National Health Pass, which now can only be obtained through vaccination or recovery from the infection. Italy's public transport, restaurants, hotels, museums, gyms and leisure places are required to check the pass before providing their services to the citizens.
We are not against the vaccine. My daughters and I have been vaccinated. Furthermore, we don't hold it against the Italian fellow citizens who got vaccinated. It was their choice and we respect it. We are sick and tired of being considered just numbers for statistics. We are human beings, citizens, with our rights and freedoms.
The organizers of the protest say they are not supporting the no-vax movement, but are very concerned over the socio-economic consequences of the restrictions. Thousands of small and medium-sized companies that make up the bulk of the Italian economy have been forced to shut down due to the coronavirus lockdowns.
Retailers, shopkeepers, everybody knows full well that the new restrictions will hit them even harder. Scientific experts have explained that the vaccine offers partial protection against transmission or of infection from the virus. This green pass is just a way to control us.
Despite Italy recording over 180,000 COVID-related cases on Saturday, the daily number of reported coronavirus infections in Italy has begun to fall in recent days. However, scientific experts say the Omicron wave has not peaked just yet.
On top of the pandemic's socioeconomic effects, Italy is bracing for the upcoming presidential election. Lawmakers will elect the country's next president on January 24, with current Prime Minister Mario Draghi among the contenders. The possibility of a government crisis cannot be ruled out. Max Civili, Rome.
The U.S. levied sanctions on six North Korean officials and two organizations following Washington's rebukes of Pyongyang at the United Nations. North Korea conducted several ballistic missile tests over the past week, including two Friday afternoon. But North Korea's ally China believes the sanctions raise tension. Since sanctions began 15 years ago, North Korea has developed a credible nuclear threat. Pyongyang argues that it has a right to self-defense in the face of U.S. hostility, which includes military exercises of the 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea. The U.S.-led U.N. Security Council sanctions against North Korea seek to encourage Pyongyang to negotiate denuclearization.
The UN Security Council sanctions against North Korea are being carried out mainly by the US and Japan, along with several other countries. Hence, if the US and Japan truly seek the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, they should stop sanctions and conduct dialogue and diplomacy with North Korea.
South Korea also favors sanctions relief for North Korea, with its unification ministry Friday vowing to continue efforts at providing humanitarian aid. South Korea has also called for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War, although the U.S. has shown little interest. South Korean President Moon Jae-in has made repeated attempts to bring the U.S. and North Korea together for meaningful dialogue. But with Moon's term set to expire this May, this last round of U.S. sanctions will likely deal a final blow to President Moon's peace-building efforts. Frank Smith, Seoul.
At a press conference in Moscow, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov touched not only on negotiations with the West, but also the peacekeeping operation in Kazakhstan and the upcoming meeting of the presidents of Iran and Russia.
The visit, in short, is very important. It's time to resume contacts at the highest level, which are traditionally close and regular among us, and which also fell victim to the coronavirus infection. The significance of the visit, first of all, is the need to take an inventory of our entire agenda, taking into account considering the new government in Iran.
Lavrov added that Moscow is in favor of holding a conference on security in the Persian Gulf, where it would be possible to discuss the claims accumulated both by Iran against its Arab neighbors and by its Arab neighbors against the Islamic Republic.
Such forum can unite Iranians and Arabs. Each of the parties would put their concerns on the table. They would also talk about their concerns over Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and other volatile areas that somehow cause controversy between other countries.
Regarding relations with the West, Russia has come up with offers of security guarantees as its patience has run out. Moscow is waiting for the West to give a concrete and written answer to its initiative and is not going to wait indefinitely. Last month, Russia's foreign ministry published draft security proposals between Moscow and Washington on ensuring the security of Russia and NATO member states. Consultations on these issues were held on January 10th in Geneva, a session of the NATO-Russia Council was held on January 12th in Brussels, and a meeting of the OSCE Permanent Council took place on January 13th in Vienna.
The appearance of NATO on the Russian borders is categorically unacceptable. This is a real red line. The appearance of U.S. weapons and military bases there on the Sea of Azov is the second red line. It simply reflects the West's overreach, to put it bluntly, in violation of all obligations, in violation of common sense.
Lavrov's